WNBC and WNBC-FM New York. Next time you visit New York's Radio City, don't forget to include the popular RCA Exhibition Hall in your itinerary. Thrilled to the newest developments in electronics. Admission is free, doors open daily at 11 a.m.
Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, the original radio program where books become battlegrounds as authors cross swords with their severest critics, the nation's top book reviewers. Today's guest is one of the best-known writers of our time, Lewis Bromfield, and our book this afternoon is his latest novel, The Wild Country. Our guest critics, here to draw blood if possible, are Mr. Olin Clark and Miss Edith Walton. But first, here's the champion of justice, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Last week's issue of Life magazine gave you a close-up of our author today, who is Louis Bromfield. He's been called the only farmer in America who has written 24 books, won a Pulitzer Prize, and habitually eats breakfast in bed. Most of you remember his best-selling novels, The Rains Came, Mrs. Parkington, and his recent book, Malabar Farm, in which he told how he transformed his 1,000 acres of wasteland in Ohio into a flourishing farm. Now, in his new novel, The Wild Country, Mr. Bromfield the farmer and Mr. Bromfield the novelist have put their heads together to fuse the love of the good earth with the knowledge of men's hearts. First, let's hear how our critics feel about this fusion. A statement from the opposition comes now. The well-known critic and editor, Miss Edith Walton.
I dislike this novel, despite its smooth, suave style, because it seems to me to be phony and hollow and contrived. I think that Mr. Bromfield has indulged in romantic trickery, as he so often does. The whole logic of the story calls for a tragic ending. Instead, he smooths out all difficulties with all too much ease, and frankly, I don't care for it.
Well, and now we hear another viewpoint from the Eastern Story editor of MGM, Mr. Olin Clark.
When a master storyteller has a real story to tell, an exciting story, told simply and movingly about people who live and love and hate and work out their destinies as we all have to do, when the author really makes you care about those people and what happens to them, then you have a good book, a book such as The Wild Country.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Bromfield, you've been on The Author Meets the Critics before, so I'm sure that you're going to be able to contain yourself till you have a chance to join the battle. That is, I am relatively sure that you're going to be able to contain yourself. But before letting our critics of the afternoon fall to, I'd like to give a brief account of the story of The Wild Country for the benefit of those who have not yet read the book. The Wild Country is the story of the awakening to life and love and death of Ronnie, a 13-year-old boy. His parents are dead, and in the summer he lives on his grandfather's farm in Missouri. Ronnie's grandfather and his great-aunt Susan bring the boy up to a love of nature, a sense of loyalty and justice, and to good sportsmanship. Ronnie has the kind of knowledge which comes of close living and working on a farm where horses are bred and there is rough talk around the stables, but he's still unaware of the pitfalls of the heart. As the story opens, Ronnie's hero and companion, a prosperous young farmer in the neighborhood named Henry, has just brought back from the St. Louis Fair a most unlikely woman as his wife. The valley buzzes with sharp gossip. Who is this creature with the foreign accent and the much too yellow hair? Ronnie, seeing Vinnie, Henry's wife, for the first time, feels only that she has come between him and Henry to spoil the long walks and the work at Henry's side. But Vinnie, the foreign peasant woman who knows so well how to cherish the land, also knows how to win the affection of a sensitive boy. Ronnie might never have understood Vinnie fully as a woman, however, if Wayne Torrance, the slick young lawyer, had not come back for his annual visit to the farm and brought into the mind of the growing boy a new feeling of distrust. Ronnie's instinct is truer than he knows. One hot afternoon in the wild country beyond the farm, he overhears Wayne and Vinnie in a crucial conflict in which the violence of human passion is at stake. Many other characters play their unwitting part in Ronnie's development, but it is the aftermath of this incident which determines his coming of age. Now, Miss Walton, do you wish to return to the attack on Mr. Bromfield, which I must say you fell to with a great deal of bounce and obvious joy?
Well, yes, I think I would. I think one trouble with this book is that Mr. Bromfield is not really a subjective novelist. He's a romantic storyteller. He's an entertainer. He's a spinner of tales. And here he has attempted something in which I believe that he is beyond his depth, so to speak. I think the handling of this story, though often sensitive, is equally often obvious and banal. I don't think that Mr. Bromfield, successful and talented as he is, has quite the equipment for this kind of a story. I think he meant it seriously and sincerely. I don't think it develops that way in the end.
Mr. Clark, do you want to make any comment on the somewhat general comments you got from Miss Walton?
I certainly do. I couldn't agree with Miss Walton less. I think that it is every author's privilege to work within his self-imposed limits. If within those limits he does the job that he starts out to do, then he is successful. I like this book immensely. It's not a great book. It's not a big book. I'm sure that Mr. Bromfield didn't intend that it should be. But he did succeed in doing what he started out to do. It's a darn good story, and it is very well told.
Mr. Clark, you are going to trap me into nastier and nastier remarks. I can see that. What I object to also about the book is that I think Mr. Bromfield insults the reader's intelligence. He is constantly saying, watch the boy grow. See how sensitively he reacts to this, that, and the other thing. And the trouble is that his reactions are broadly typical reactions of an adolescent. They're not personal ones. Ronnie's character is not really developed. In fact, I think there are very few characters that are well developed in this book.
And well, what about the character of Vinny?
Vinny is good, but Vinny is essentially a tragic figure. That is a point I made in the beginning and wish to stress. This story should have ended tragically. It is cheating to have it end in any other way, at least from my point of view.
I can see Vinny as a pathetic character, but I can't see her as a tragic character. Mr. Clark.
Well, I wonder whether Miss Walton is entirely qualified to talk about the growing up pains of a boy. She's never been one, I am quite sure.
I am sure that she has contributed to the growing up pains of a boy.
Thank
here
you,
and there,
Mr.
but
that could be, but having been one myself many, many, many years ago, and I still remember those days, I think that character is beautifully drawn. I could feel everything that Ronnie felt as I read that book. I think he's an individual. He's a three-dimensional character. He is not what Miss Walton said.
Miss Walton, now what about the dimensions of this boy that you only knew in a romantic way?
Of course, I don't agree at all. Again, I find myself getting nastier and nastier. The first half of the book struck me as very dull. It isn't until you come to the melodrama at the end, in the second half, that you really begin to get interested. The reason for that, I think, is that Ronnie is not individualized. You have all the business of a boy with his dog. I have read the story of the boy with his dog and how touching their relationship is. Again and again and again, and it's only when the boy is individualized that you care about him, that you can bear that sort of thing. All his reactions to love, to death, they're obvious. They have been said again and again and again, and Mr. Bromfield delivers himself of a great many rather distressing platitudes on the subject of how boys and adolescents feel. If you compare this book with a book, say, like Elizabeth Bowen's Death of the Heart, where you really get the subtle inner feelings of a highly individualized adolescent, you realize, at least I realize, where Mr. Bromfield has fallen short.
Mr. Clark is shaking his head over here.
Well, I wish we could find some rather similar, if not common, point of view. To me, the great beauty of Mr. Bromfield's book was what he did not say. It was what he left in unsaid.
What did he leave out? He said practically everything, I thought.
Well, evidently, Mr. Clark had a pang or two as a boy that he is not willing to bring up here on the program, and he feels that...
you said
Mr.
this was a family program.
Yeah. Mr. Bromfield left that unsaid. Well, now, Mr. Clark, it was during the time that you and I were associated at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer that this book was bought by MGM. Do you believe that this book is open to the criticism that it was written for the movies?
I do not.
Huh? What makes you think it wasn't?
Because the book is too honest.
I see. Do you feel that the ending in any way was determined by the needs of making it into a movie? For instance, Miss Walton would like it to be a tragic ending, really tragic. But in this case, after all, it's really Mr. Torrance that takes the big rap, doesn't he?
Well, I'll say no to your question about the tragic ending being influenced by the movies in any way. I do have certain reservations about that ending. I think that Mr. Bromfield rushed a little bit, so to speak. There's a distinct change of tempo and pace, which I thought threw the book a little out of key. But I have no doubt that Mr. Bromfield did that for certain purposes, and it's his privilege to do that.
Well, now, Miss Walton, do you feel that the movies have influenced Mr. Bromfield's writing in
the
book?
Why, sure I do. Of course I do.
Well, would you document your belief?
I think that even Mr. Bromfield possibly intended to have a tragic ending in the beginning. The whole build-up is for a tragic ending.
I see. Well, I think that the only thing we can do at this point, then, is to bring on our author of the afternoon and to ask him what his intentions were, and also to ask him if he feels a little nasty toward you, Miss Walton. And here is our author of the afternoon, Mr. Louis Bromfield.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I don't think Mr. Walton has been very nasty. I suspect that the point of view is influenced by two things, Miss Walton. The approach for the critical approach, well, really three. One is, I think Miss Walton is taking the attitude of the professional feminist.
That's right.
I also think she hasn't been around very much.
That must hurt more, Miss Walton.
Just you
and
wait.
And the third thing, I also think she is the woman editor point of view a good deal, because that's something I've had long experience with. The editors of women's magazines I've had to deal with off and on, and did in the case of this particular book. As you're writing it for the pictures, I'm very happily in the position where I don't have to do that. And I write a book like that because I enjoy writing it. As to the subjective part, I have never the faintest desire to be a subjective novelist. The subjective novelist runs out of material just as a well runs out of water. And we've had plenty of those in our history of our American literature in the last generation or two, where after about two books, the well goes dry and they keep writing the same one over. As to any slur connected with storytelling, the greatest compliment you can pay any novelist is that he is a good storyteller. The books that survive in history are essentially stories. I could recommend Ms. Walton the best book on the novel, some aspect of the novel by Ian Foster, in which he points that out.
I've read it.
There are two qualities to any great novel which has survived. One is that it's a great story, and that applies for anybody down from Tolstoy on down. The other thing is that every great novel, I'm not talking about anything, a word I've ever written, but one great test of every great novel is that within two pages, the reader loses himself in a world which becomes as real to him as the world outside. If a novel doesn't have that, it never becomes a great novel. And most subjective novels lack that entirely. They never create a world or characters in which people live. As to Vinny and the tragic ending, if there ever was a character in fiction, good or bad, who was meant to triumph, to overcome everything and achieve a happy ending for herself, it's Vinny. She was very close to everything that was fundamental. She was very close. She had no nonsense. She had no, never heard of psychiatrists. She was very fundamental. She was down to earth. She knew the values of life, which a woman in her position should certainly know. And she was determined to fight for them and did fight for them. If ever a woman would go inevitably toward a happy ending, no matter what happened, it was that woman.
Well, now, Miss Walton, I'd like to bring you in here to comment on this comment of Mr. Bromfield.
I don't think Mr. Bromfield has read his own book. I really don't.
He wrote it. Maybe you don't have to write it.
Well, he hasn't read it recently, then. Because early in the story, when Henry first meets Vinnie, she is on the verge of committing suicide. She is therefore not quite so simple and uncomplicated a character, nor quite so in love with life. Secondly, when she had this encounter with Wayne, she said, "If I weren't a coward, I should kill myself." And being the person of integrity and honesty that she is presented as being, I think she would have killed herself myself.
That's complete nonsense. A psychiatrist's subject would, but not that woman. They don't kill themselves. That's the kind of people who go to be psychoanalyzed to talk.
Why was she so nearly committing suicide in the beginning then?
She wasn't. She never would have done it.
Well, you said she was.
I didn't. She said so. I never said anything about it. And that's what good storytelling is. I never said any or made any comment, whatever. She said that.
You mean, Miss Walton, that we are to believe everything that every woman says?
Obviously, you don't believe a word of what I say.
Not much.
In other words, Mr. Bromfield, your point on Vinnie is that precisely the fact that she doesn't commit suicide, no matter how many times she may it may occur to her that she speaks of it,
proves that this
dominant need to live and to triumph is an integral part of her personality.
That's right. I've known a couple of women who were great suicide talkers, but by God, they never did it.
You say that as if you regretted the fact, Mr. Bromfield.
They can use it for a lot of things, but and no sane woman ever does it.
All right, I'll switch my viewpoint then. In that case, I think the whole technique of the story is bad. From the beginning, a feeling of doom is built up. The child's grandfather and his aunt feel grim and depressed when they first meet Vinnie. They know that trouble is ahead. The neighbors feel that when a woman of that type comes to the valley, it's bound to end in disaster. And so on and so forth. I mean, it's a tragic buildup. And how do you end? You end with a very bad epilogue. With a middle-aged Vinnie, the mother of six children, her son about to become a governor, everything just too darling and rosy. And more than that, the grandfather gets back his wife, who deserted him 30 years before, and she lives in beauty and peace.
Well, that's all right. That was a civilized. That was again.
Novel.
I tell you that you haven't been around enough. That's a perfectly civilized solution, and those two were very civilized people. As to the atmosphere of doom, the story would have had no
Mr.
point.
Mr. Bromfield, may
I am writing about country and people, which I know, which I've grown up with and born with, and grew up my own childhood, and I'm living among them now. I know that is exactly what happens when a woman comes into a valley. A woman of that sort, it makes no difference how she ends up. That is inevitable. I mean, as inevitable as the sun rises tomorrow. You can't come or have her come in there and have all the neighbors come out and welcome her and give her a reception when she's obviously a tart. I mean, you can't do it.
What's wrong with a happy ending anyway?
It isn't. Well, that's one of the silliest conventions, which again, Miss Walton, represents the psychiatrist approach for women editors who take the point of view that every story to be art must have a bad ending. And that is perfectly naive point of view.
I have never worked on a woman's magazine in my life. I have spent a good deal of my life reviewing books like yours.
That's right.
And I have always felt that the trouble with your books were that they were too civilized.
Oh, that's right.
That you are never willing to look reality in the face.
That's
and I don't think you do in this book either.
Oh, I think I do very much in this book. And that saying you do or you don't hasn't got anything to do with it. But I don't think that's true. I think one of the things that's the trouble with American novels today, and God knows I'm not the only one who says there's something the matter with the American novel, because everybody, the papers have been filled with, and why aren't there any good novels, is a more or less total lack of civilization in the American novel as a whole, and the tendency to simply write sensation all the time and not get down to brass tacks and write a civilized novel. I can't think of any American, I can think of one or two, but most of them come out of England. Any civilized novel today are out of France. We get a lot of ferocious satires, a lot of sensational books dealing with tolerance and all the rest of them, but those are not essentially literature and never can be.
Well, now, Mr. Bromfield, when you've used the word civilized over and over again, and almost to link it with a happy ending. And are you willing to come out then for a statement on life that general people's lives have happy endings?
Civilized people's lives don't necessarily have happy endings. They are wise enough, intelligent enough, and experienced enough to know that no story is always wholly tragic or wholly triumphant and happy. That
but
life,
this is pretty
essentially, for 95, me. Not particularly, she worked for it, she earned it. 95% of the lives of people are simply a matter of compromise and intelligence if they're successful lives. Otherwise, then they can be a tragedy. But to be tragic, people, the characters, and people, most of all, have to have tragic stature in themselves. And most people don't have that.
Mr. Clark? Could I go back to something that Miss Walton said a moment ago, that the feeling of impending doom was planted in the very first pages of the book? I don't think that is so. The book starts out in a wonderfully rhythmic way. As Mr. Bromfield says, you lose yourself in another country before you've read many paragraphs. And it is stated explicitly that there had been seeds of evil sown in that valley years before, which were bound to bear fruit sometime. They did bear fruit. I don't think the book is a particularly happy book. Then he comes out all right. Wayne has to go away. He loses his integrity. There are two deaths, if you'll remember.
Indeed, I do remember.
Well, then I don't call that especially happy book. I say, with Mr. Bromfield, that it's a triumphant book, and I think
it
is.
I think that's the purpose of the
book. May I say something about those deaths?
Yeah.
Well,
did
yes.
he?
I don't know what you're going to say. This is a tentative acceptance on my part, Miss Long.
Vinny is almost caught out in what was virtually a crime, that is, pushing this Wayne over a cliff. One man sees her coming away from the spot where it happened and knows that something is wrong. According to the ordinary logic of circumstances, she would be exposed. But what happens? The man who saw her gets poisoned conveniently. Just within a few...
He doesn't get poisoned very conveniently, as this thing has been going on for 10 years. It just happens to occur at that time. The other...
It worked out nice for your plot, I admit that.
The other thing, which is also, I think, a little off base in your argument, is that she was almost caught out, and she wasn't caught out, because the whole basis of the tragedy, which ended in two deaths, started a long time ago, before she ever came to the valley, even. It
was
bound to happen someday. And as the old man says, the seeds of it were there long before, and they were bound to come to no good end, and he knew it from the first page of the book. And they happened to come at that time.
Well, it's very good defense, Mr.
Brown. Now, look, I'm a writer. I'm a novelist. And it doesn't mean a thing, that neatness. There is such a thing as a tragic rule. And that was a tragic rule in operation, if you want to talk about tragedy and writing and literature and so forth. I'm a good enough writer, God knows, and a skillful enough one. You say I'm too slick, all right. I didn't need to kill those people off. That had a perfect bearing on the whole thing. It was a symbolic thing. I can get her out of that 50 million ways. I'm old and experienced writer, and I know how to do that 50 ways. I didn't have to kill them off just to get her
out. I'm sure you could have gotten her off.
50 ways of getting her out.
Well, as a matter of fact, I am have been considerably interested during our discussion. I hope you have no easy method of killing off critics, Mr. Brownfield. I have been interested that Mr. Clark and Miss Walton have spent so much time on the plot of The Wild Country, because in reading it, I can't help but think about the fact that there's very little plot of it. Plot of this could be contained very, very easily within a short story, and that to me, over 70% of the book was a country idyll. An idol of a small boy growing up on a farm. And Mr. Brownfield spends much more time on that than he does on the mechanics of this plot.
Well, I think what you said, Mr. McCaffrey, is that in the beginning is true, and what was done consciously and has been often done consciously before, that most of the story is not written. It's a question of the implications of the reactions of the reader, plus the experience of the reader to understand what wasn't written.
I think that was Mr. Clark's.
Mr. Clark, but that's really the truth. There's a great deal, most of it's unsaid, actually.
Well, now...
I couldn't disagree more.
Most of it is unsaid.
Mr. Clark.
The real important things are unsaid.
Well, Mr.
I feel that there's some unsaid things here at this table, I must confess. Go ahead, Mr. Clark.
I just wonder if we're all talking about the same book.
Well... maybe this shows how various Mr. Brownfield's talents are. Where do you object to this present conversation?
Well, Miss Walton has made her case out principally, as I see it, on the basis of the plotting and what Mr. Brownfield has chosen to do with his novelist technique. To me, this novel was a novel of character. The plot was incidental to the characters, and I was intensely interested in them. I knew them, I loved them, I wanted to know what happened to them. I didn't love them all. But
as characters, you love
exactly,
them.
And I think we're discussing this on the wrong basis.
Well, there is a very good definition of the difference between story and plot, and E.M. Forster again is responsible for that. A plot is something which you invent and fit the characters to, and a story is something in which you find the characters first, and because of their background, because of their personal qualities and character, they invent their own story and make their own fate. And all fate is a combination of character and circumstance. And you can put the same situation to 10 people, and you will have 10 different stories according to the character and force of those people.
Well, I was further interested, Mr. Brownfield, in some of the ways in which you accomplished your characterization in the book. I think anyone reading through could not help but have been struck with the fact that you tended to relate your characterization to something on the farm, to something on the land, to the animals even on the land, the stallions or the cows and so forth and so on. Well, now, it occurred to me that that's a pretty simple way to accomplish a characterization. Merely to take Wayne Torrance in his virility and his sensuality and relate him constantly through incident and through description to the breeding farm and so forth seems to me a fairly... A simple way of getting across the character of Wayne Torrance. It's not a very complex character.
It's not a very complex character. It was pure sensuality and vitality. And never once in the book does it ever say that any character was like this animal or that one.
No, but the implication is very strong.
Then the implication is very successful that you saw it that way. It's never stated. It's never overdone. If that association grew up in your mind, then I've accomplished exactly what I wanted to do, which was to say Wayne Torrance was out a stallion, was like a stallion without ever saying it.
But there must have been more to the Wayne Torrance, who was a successful politician, who was a highly successful man in not only in purely political life, but in business life and all of the things that surround that. He must have been something more than this animal that you describe him at through the book. And it seems to me,
how many politicians have you known?
Very few that reminded me of stallions.
I can tell you something of that. But never forget, good, bad, corrupt, or indifferent, that vitality is the keynote of every successful politician. And never forget it. And that's true. And it may be, he may be corrupt, he may be noble, he may be all the rest. From Woodrow Wilson or Franklin D. Roosevelt down to the worst little ward politician, but vitality and very often sensuality is part of the story, always.
Isn't that true of all successful men outside of the scientists?
Men,
so they have to have that vitality.
I presume it is. I can only hope then that Mr. Bromfield's next novel will be on political themes. Miss Walton, are there any characters that that you were dissatisfied with, except for Vinnie?
Well, I was very much dissatisfied with the grandmother, Melissa. I didn't think she belonged in the story at all.
Well, I tell you, I haven't been around enough.
If you say that often enough, I may believe it.
Melissa, what the book is about is a boy's reaction, the discovery in adolescence of a rather sensitive, solitary boy brought up by grandparents, not by parents. To finding out what is going on in the world. And he finally finds it out and fits it together in a pattern through tragic, melodramatic circumstance, if you want. But in the background, what you have is a series of manifestations of sex, romance, love, whatever you call it. And the grandfather and the grandmother's love was on the most civilized possible plane of understanding, of intelligence, of knowledge, of tolerance, of intellectual background. And when she went away with another man 30, 35 years earlier, the grandfather loved her so much that he understood that. And being a civilized person, he said, someday she'll probably come back. Which she did. And being civilized people and loving each other very much, it made no difference when she did come back. And if you'll remember, the one comment that was made on her character was that she was always a pleasing character, and that's the greatest thing you can say about any woman anytime, is that she was pleasing.
How do you feel about Miss Walton?
Well, she could be pleasing. Miss Walton could be pleasing. She has the potentiality.
I think my point is, Mr. Bromfield, that why should Melissa have come into Ronnie's story? If we hadn't had Melissa or any mention of her, if the judge hadn't had a wife, what difference would it have made?
All right, it's all the difference between when Ronnie growing up, and there's a scene where he comes back to the wild country after he's seen his grandmother and a blind French lover, and he looks at the same landscape, and it's a different landscape because he's known Melissa. It's a landscape in which he sees the difference between civilization and non-civilization in this same wild Missouri swamp. He sees it as Poussin might have painted it, as Turner, as Constable, and he becomes civilized in that moment. It's the difference between merely looking at a wild swamp and seeing it in terms of art. And she did that, as most pleasing women are able to do always.
Well, you've extricated yourself from the wild country of The Author Meets the Critics very well, Mr. Bromfield. I'm sorry the time's up for everybody. And here's Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, the battleground for The Author Meets the Critics will be a motion picture, a new movie which is not yet released and is scheduled to open in November. It is The Sealed Verdict by Lionel Shapiro, taken from last year's best-selling novel of the same name. We'll bring you a lively discussion pro and con on The Sealed Verdict next week at the same time. We hope you'll join us. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank you, Louis Bromfield, for coming here today to discuss The Wild Country, and to thank you, Edith Walton and Olin Clark, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
Welcome Meet the Critics has come to you from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City, produced by Martin Stone, directed by Lee Jones. This is Bob Cherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.